Blog Talk Radio.
Sun and live from the cafe, and also the soon-to-be-released Searching for Roy Buchanan. I have to go back a couple of years. I met Olivia Barrier at a library event in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. She is the author of a number of short and semi-long works that include The World That Forgot How to Dance, The Bard's Choice, A Book Without Dragons, and others, worlds that merge the modern and medieval, the dystopian and somewhat idyllic, such as in another of her works, Sisters, A Sorceress, Curses, and Songs. Olivia, welcome aboard.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you, and this is going to be sort of an extension of that meeting at the library and then the subsequent talks that we've had over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And
awesome.
I just think it's going to be something of that sort. I'm going to have to dive right in with Sisters, A Sorceress, and so forth. Let's just
awesome.
Go right to this because from the beginning, here are two sisters, Emmeline and Tira, sisters of some talent, but they seem very much opposites. Tell us about them and this world that you throw us into, like, right from the beginning.
Sure, yeah. Well, sisters are both musicians. They perform together, Tira on the violin, Emmeline on the flute. Their differences come in the way that they view their career. Emmeline is more of the serious, the very career-focused. She's really interested in playing for, you know, more important patrons and continuing to grow their career and be seen as more professional and serious. Whereas Tira is, she's seen by her sister as kind of being unmotivated, but really it's more that she has different goals in life. Like her, you know, like to her family and happiness and senses of well-being, like that's more important to her than being the super famous musician. Like she's happy just to be playing the violin anywhere to anybody.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny because in my old band, way back at the beginning, I worked with two women very much of that. One was very serious goal-oriented, if I may say, and the other was a bit more laid back and nonetheless talented. And, well, one ended up leaving, but when I started to read that, there they were, and I thought, there's an identification right there.
Oh, that's cool.
And the other thing, too, is their qualities are well-drawn. And the thing is, though, as you say, this is not just sisterly rivalry. And,
right. You
know, it's really interesting because they have characteristics that make both of them neither completely positive or negative. And that, where did the templates come from for these two ladies?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to say. I don't necessarily base characters off of people I know in real life. I feel like that limits what I can do with them, how much I feel I can control them. But the seed, I think, of both of their characters was a conversation I had with a friend of mine where she was just kind of talking about her brother and how unmotivated he was and how she's like, oh, he's so talented, he would be so successful if he would just do things. And just kind of wondering, it's like, okay, how would that play out if you were in a situation where it wasn't just I'm concerned about my sibling, but also my livelihood depends on my sibling in a way because they work together.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
The first thing I knew about them was that dynamic that Emmeline kind of felt like, oh, my sister is, you know, dragging me down in this career. And Tira feels that, you know, oh, my sister is prioritizing this career over our relationship. And I'm just, you know, I'm just something that she uses in her career rather than being her sister. So once I had that settled, all of their other characteristics kind of grew out of that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And you take us back. When is this actually set? Because it sounds like a medieval time where here are performers that are playing for these wealthy patrons and hoping to maybe get some more work and make some more money that way. Where
right.
do you, and I've seen that before in some of the other works you've done. Where are we in this time frame?
Right. It is a completely separate world from ours. But like a lot of fantasy, it does take a lot of cues from like medieval Europe. You have like, you know, the lord systems, you have highborns and lowborns, you know, people dealing coins instead of dollars. And a lot of that, I mean, while it is kind of a stereotypical fantasy, I kind of did that on purpose because the book is so short that I needed the world to be something that fantasy readers can be like, oh, okay, I got this. We're in a fantasy world. Let's go. Because I feel like if it's, you know, it's only a, you know, 100-page book, you don't want to spend 30 of those pages building up the world. Interesting factoid, I'm not sure if you were aware of this, but that and The Bard's Choice are actually in the same world.
Ah.
It's not something that's really addressed, but if you look really, really closely, I do mention one crossover character and a couple other little Easter eggs in there for anyone who wants to read real close.
That's cool. And
thanks.
The interesting thing, too, is there are some gritty characters, and I don't mean the Philadelphia Flyers mascot. I mean, you know, there's some pretty rough characters, such as when, you know, like the lady who seems quite manipulative and some of the hirelings and some of their quirks and so forth.
I had so much fun with her. She was so much fun to work with as a villain. Just because, like, she's not like physically intimidating, you know. She's just powerful and just very, very focused on what she wants. And you know, coming from a really bad background where she like suffered a lot as a child, and it just produced this person who just feels so entitled to all of the pain that she's causing other people, and having that not mean anything to her because she feels like she's earned this life now. So she was just so much fun for me to play with.
There was a certain oiliness about her.
Yeah,
that's
like
the
that.
Right term. Because she was sort of, I can't approximate where it would come from, but it was like in one of those old movies where you would have this despotic sort of ruler that has had a horrible early life that no one knows about, and then his attitude is, it is my turn now.
Right.
Now, there's an interesting thing, too. We were talking about it earlier, I think, when you may have already answered this, but filling out that persona, you get to a certain point, and then I find that as I write on after creating a character, all of a sudden, as I'm writing or as I'm editing, something pops up in my mind and says, oh, hey, that's so-and-so. We better write that in.
Definitely. Oh yeah, no, definitely. I like the first draft, like the first, you know, couple chapters of the first draft, like all the characters are just as bland as can be, cuz I really meet them through writing the story, and then it's my job to go back in subsequent edits to like, okay, let's actually give them personalities for the beginning of the book.
And that was the thing. I often interview my characters, and as I have said to you, is I like to let them talk. And over time, if I'm putting myself in their shoes and answering the questions, they start to become pretty real to me. And I think you talked about that a little bit of what you do.
Like you said, interviewing them is great. Like, especially for me, asking questions that have like nothing to do with the book, like questions that, you know, that aren't related to the plot at all, questions that I could ask to any character, but their answers will tell me something about them. You know, like I have a question that, you know, pops up in my surveys. What would you do with a broken grandfather clock? You know, where, you know, the villain would be like, you know, I'd throw it out because it's worthless, you know, whereas Tira would be like, well, I'd try to fix it. And Emmeline would be like, you know, maybe it's worth something for parts. Maybe I can sell it. So, I mean, even though, like, there's no grandfather clock in the story, there may not be grandfather clocks in their fantasy world at all. Their reaction to that tells me a lot about them and how to compare them to each other. Also, I think delving into their past kind of helps, too. Like, even if it's not in the book, I'm not very good at writing flashbacks in the book. I have trouble with the transitions. That's something you do very well, by the way. I noticed that in Moment in the Sun, you have really nice transitions between present story and then filling in that backstory. I thought that was very cool.
Oh, thanks. Well, that was one thing. If it's for any aspiring writer or any author to consider, I used to jump very early in my writing back and forth between
mm-hmm.
the here, the now, the before, and all that. And someone had said to me, "You need to break that up." I can't even remember who this was. It was so many years ago, but they said,
"Yeah,
even if you don't do a new chapter, they're like, you got to break it up, so that we know when one scene ends and another view begins." And
right, yeah.
And so that's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I also noticed that you have very nice, like when you read like the last line of the scene, you kind of know it's like, okay, we're probably going to be jumping back even before you read the next line. You're like, oh, we're younger now. So it's like you kind of end the scene in a way that like it could only go backwards from there. You could only be going back in time after that.
Oh, that's good. Let me say, I assume that that's good.
No, it's absolutely good. Because, I mean, I don't like, you know, when I'm reading a book, like, I don't necessarily like to be confused. I mean, as much as I write confusing stuff, I think it's nice to be, like, challenged, like, oh, that's an interesting structure, but I don't want to be wasting my emotional energy, like, trying to decide, okay, are we in the past or are we in the future? So as long as, when it's obvious, you can just kind of, you know, stay with the characters.
Mm-hmm. In terms of basing characters on real people, either those
mm-hmm.
you know or maybe even historical figures, is there any view on how many or how much, or does that just come with each character or each story you do?
Oh, man. It's got to be different for each story. I mean, and some of it doesn't come out until, like, research, like, for a book without dragons, I have a police officer character in there, and you know he was kind of like half formed. But then I started doing research on police officers, and you know I saw interviews and stuff, and like so a lot of those interviews and that tone kind of pushed its way into that character. So it really really depends on the project and what kind of research I'm doing for the character.
Mm-hmm. That's cool, and. Sort of moving into a little larger question here, the short
mm-hmm.
form seems to do really well for you. Now, Book Without Dragons
yeah.
feels like a full book to me, and it certainly read that way nicely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Is it your main preference for the short pieces, or is that just how it comes out?
It's kind of just how it comes out, honestly. Like, all of my short pieces, I didn't really set out to be like, oh, I'm going to write a novelette here. I always was like, oh, this would make a really cool short story. And then I would write
mm-hmm.
it, and it would maybe top out at about, 7,000, 10,000 words. And,
mm-hmm.
you could just tell that, there was a little too much here for a short story. It felt, it felt chunky. It felt crammed. But I knew that there wasn't enough to, like if I were to stretch that out into a full-length book, then the idea would just kind of get diluted. I might lose a bit of the charm that I wanted in the original idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of worked out that expanding it to that like 17,000-20,000 word length was really effective for those stories. I think
mm-hmm.
it just all has to do with the idea itself and what kind of space you require to tell that story to completion.
And there was the thing, there was no limit for you, or there was no minimum either, which was kind of cool.
Right. Yeah, that is cool.
Now, you're the first
kind
person
of
I've ever heard. Go ahead.
I was just going to say,
no,
that kind of comes
to.
From...
You're the guest.
that kind of comes from self-publishing. That's sort of the freedom that comes with that, because I don't know if any traditional publisher would be interested in a book of that really weird misfit length. So that's kind of been really fun to be able to play with that longer than a short story, shorter than a book length.
And you're the first person I've ever heard use the term novelette. Is that yours, or did you find that someplace else?
I would love to think that it's mine, but I'm sure I read it somewhere first. I'm not sure even if that's considered the correct term for it. I think it fits, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like if I say novelette, people are going to picture a book that's around that size.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to say, oh, yes, I made up that word, and then find out that it had actually seeped into my subconscious earlier.
That's cool. The interesting thing too, there's the thing, the short form does work in certain ways, and I did some research to get ready for this interview, and I think it was through your blog. There, you had a very early short piece called Ball
mm-hmm.
Girl. And
oh my gosh, that
I,
was my first published piece.
Okay, because
yeah,
you
that was
told
my very
a full
first one.
story in like a page
Yes.
or two, and I was like, whoa, how about that?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I do
now
love
tell me
flash
about
fiction.
That story. We must go there.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. Like, that's obviously not the first story I've written. I've been writing since I was a kid, but that was the first story that I got that fabled acceptance letter back from. It was published by Everyday Fiction in 2007. The story, I mean, you can probably guess at the inspiration for it. I was a ball girl for a soccer game once. And while I was doing it, not necessarily that I lived out Lisa's, story in that, but as I was doing it, I'm like, wow, you know what? I didn't know anything about this helper position, and it's kind of cool to be here. It's something that, I feel like you could take a lot of pride in this. So I was just like, you know what? I'm gonna see if I can play with that a little bit. And again, it was just such a quick little idea that, I just felt like I really didn't need much more than that.
And it's true, because you told the whole story. You took an innocuous person that most people would take for granted if they're watching a soccer match of any kind, but there's somebody doing something that's important to the flow of the game, because you know they need balls, and they need somebody to bring them, they need somebody to gather them and such. And
absolutely.
I just, the directness of it was what got me, and that was the thing that I had noticed is, like, for example, one of the things you do well, for me anyway, is that there's little sometimes description of where we are, but you make it so that the reader doesn't need it. In Sisters and also
oh,
The Bard's
good.
Choice, very, very much so. It was like, it's like you said, oh, I know where I am. I kind of know what time frame I'm in. I see what's going on here. And, and you do the necessary thing. You take us there.
Thank you. I do think that that's outrageously important, particularly in fantasy, because it's so easy to get lost in world building. Like, it is so easy to set out to write, a 50,000-word novel and then have, 25,000 of it be just world building. Because, I mean, building worlds is super fun, first of all, and you have to do a lot of world building, even if it doesn't make it into the book. So the tendency is to put too much of that in there. So I do try to be really conscientious of, I mean, readers are smart. I mean, readers are just, they're smart. Fantasy readers, this probably is not their first fantasy book. There are certain things that you can hint at and they'll pick up on that and be able to fill in the rest.
And the thing too is, you make fantasy and modern worlds work almost hand in hand, because A Book Without Dragons is another example of where it seemed present time, but you also took us ahead in time a little bit. And I guess the question I have for that is this evolution of your style, do you think, from back at Ball Girl in 2007, is it influence? What do you think your growth has been like over the years?
Well, I've definitely gotten more daring, I guess, in the types of plots that I've attempted over the years. Like, I mean, I think like all writers, like I had, a few novels that I wrote when I was a teenager and whatever. And, like, obviously the quality of the writing itself has gotten better, but I'm a lot more confident in being able to play around with point of view changes, with just little, just experimental ideas, things that, kind of just shove the book off to the side a little bit. And I love that. I love the concept of experimental fiction. I'm excited that it's kind of becoming more of a thing in the world right now. And so that's kind of like, it's a cool time to be a writer and even a reader, because all of these just really, really interesting books are coming out.
What else do you see in that genre or realm for experimental fiction? What would you look at and point to and say, this is a good example of it, or maybe this is something that you were either influenced or inspired by?
Well, I mean, the one that I always think of first, because this was the first time that I kind of really had my mind open up to, like, whoa, you can do whatever you want in a book, and it can be amazing. Italo Calvino's If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. I don't know if you've read it,
yes.
But oh my God.
I have.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. You know what I'm talking about then. That book just, I read it in college. It just changed my life just because it's just so out there and so clever. And I remember like at the very end of the book, like I finished it and I had to like throw it against the wall because I was so excited about it. Like that was the only way I could express my happiness. So that's obviously the first one that jumps to mind. But there are so many cool things out there. Like there's one which I don't think anyone knows about it, but it's called Impossible Words. And there's this person who wrote flash fiction. She wrote 25 of them. And each group of five stories eliminated a vowel. And all of them only did one-syllable words. So you had a story that didn't use the letter A once, and only one-syllable words, less than 1,000 of them, and it told an actual story. And they were actual stories, though. I mean, it's like I bought it to be like, no way. But they all made sense. They were good stories.
Wow.
So that blew me away. So it's that kind of just, you know, how far could we push this and still be entertaining in a storytelling sense?
Well, I'm going to have to go. I've read a couple of Calvino's books. I'm going to have to get those off the shelf. I only read them about a year or two ago, and it's like, I have to go back and revisit that now.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think about that, and I think I don't know how else to approximate it right off the top of my head in terms of it. But I see where you're going with that, and that is something that is really intriguing. And again, you're right. It's like we can do what
mm-hmm.
we want. We're writing our own stories. We can do what
right.
we bloody well want with these.
yep, exactly.
Exactly. Our guest is Olivia Barrier here on the Brown Posey Press Show, and we're talking about her various works, including Sisters, A Sorceress, Curses, and Songs, The Bard's Choice, A Book Without Dragons, and yes, I want to get to The Bard's Choice because I see this in my own writing, and with yours, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are themes of music, but also dance and magic, and The Bard's Choice, that reminds me quite a bit of I think of Norse magic because I had a close friend who was a mentor of mine who called himself a bard because, well, he was
mm-hmm.
quite a poet and writer, and
cool.
It just led me into that. And I found it also interesting about those themes. Those obviously have something to do with your own background because of where you went to school, and it must have gone a ways further back, too.
You mean like the flavor of it or?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. A lot of that has to do with, you know, the kind of books that I read. Like, I mean, like they say, write what you know, but I think what they really mean is, you know, write what you love, write the types of books that excite
mm-hmm.
you the most. And those are the types of fantasy books that, you know, I just fell in love with, you know, and you just lost yourself in those worlds that are, you know, just a little gritty, you know, it's not all princesses and castles, you know. I love, you know, people, you know, who are, you know, really working and, you know, really like taking pride in their careers and having those careers
mm-hmm.
be something completely different than the kind of careers that we have today. So a lot of it comes from that. I do love like Celtic culture a lot. I think that's all very, very, very beautiful. And I mean, and medieval culture is just, I mean, it's just flat out fun. I mean, I think a lot of being fantasy writers, like, it's kind of just an excuse to just play around with all medieval things because, I mean, that's just kind of the romantic idea of it, you know, like, you know, it's like, oh, knights and the dresses they wore and, you know, it just all feels very, very, very pure, I guess,
mm-hmm.
very divorced
yes.
from the industrial kind of nature of today's world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, and yet at the same time, you don't make it you know, the fairy tale existence doesn't completely exist for a lot of these folks. The Bard's Choice is sort of the old cautionary tale of be careful what you wish for because of this magical stone and what it does.
Right,
that in
yeah.
itself was really it's sort of like, it's almost like the ring. It's like the the ring, as Gandalf said in paraphrase to Frodo, it is, this thing is completely corruptible, and it is corruptive of the one who has it. And the stone seems to have a lot of that. Well, it might get you what you want, but is it what you really want?
Mm-hmm. Right. Definitely. Like the idea for that one actually came like from, you know, I think I had just read a, maybe a Dean Koontz novel or something, something where a substantial part of it was told from the point of view of the villain. And I'm like, oh, that's very cool. And my first thought was, you know, oh, what if you had a story where it was entirely told by the villain and the villain was the main character? But then I thought, it's like, oh, well, if the villain's the main character for the whole thing, how would that work? And like, oh, what if they stop being the main character halfway through, which begs the question, why do they stop being the main character? And I'm like, okay, well, maybe there's something that transfers, and after it transfers, and the story kind of builds itself around that.
And it's there's a lot of these interesting themes that just sort of run through your work. We're thinking of these two that we talk about, and also, not to bounce around too much, but The World That Forgot How to Dance was another that intrigued me. It's a world where dancing is banned, but not for the reasons people might think. You opened up some more doors.
Right.
How did that happen?
Yeah. That one was had not quite as interesting as an origin story. Like, the idea started with, you know, I went to a very, very artistic school. We had a lot of dance majors. I went to, you know, performances. I don't personally dance, but I love watching other people dance, because there is a very real kind of magic, I think, that happens through dance. So, you know, as a writer, I'm like, oh, what if there was actually magic that happened while someone was dancing? So, you know, once I had that thought in my head, okay, you dance and it creates a spell. All spells are, you know, caused by dancing. Okay. Once I had that, it was like, okay, well, that in itself isn't a story. Where can I build some conflict into that? And which is why I decided, it's like, okay, well, what if you're not allowed to dance because of the magic? Where it's not necessarily, you know, it's like, oh, we don't want dancing. It's, we don't want magic. And this is how magic happens. Therefore, you can't do that anymore. Yeah.
I see. And it was very interesting, too, because you had such polar opposites, Elwine and Lester. Lester in particular looks like such a creature, and yet that's a deception.
Right.
How did they come in?
Lester was as much of a surprise to me as he was to everyone else in the book, honestly. Because, you know, honestly, I didn't really plan on him being a main character. It was just kind of like, you know, I knew I wanted to open up, you know, in a jail cell, just because the idea of, you know, this really, you know, sweet, obviously very well-meaning, you know, dancer girl being in a jail cell for dancing, that was just a really interesting image to me that I wanted to open with. But you can't just have a character sitting in a jail cell by herself being sad. So I thought, you know, having, you know, kind of like a snarky cell neighbor that she could banter with, I thought maybe that would be cool. But, like, as I was writing that scene, I'm like, this guy is actually pretty interesting. So I kind of just decided I wanted to stick with him a little bit longer and, you know, see where that goes. Like, in my original outline, which I hardly followed at all, the other girl, Denise, she was actually going to be the secondary character of the story, and her role got toned down a lot when Lester turned out to be so interesting.
And yeah, it's like you come up with this character, and then as we say, that they write themselves in a way.
Yeah, I had very, very little to do with Lester's formation. He just kind of showed up, really. Like I worked a lot at Elsie, and, you know, coming up with what her traits were and what her backstory was. Why does she love dancing? You know, how did she start dancing? You know, like, I really did work at her, and Lester just kind of happened, which is lovely and fun when it happens that way.
And there's a thing about a lot of these worlds, as it seems you're looking for a certain kind of one. And is it the one you see when you're creating this, or is it the one you would like to see?
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously, I mean, each world is going to have its flaws. Like, I'm not going to write, the utopia, but I mean, there are going to be elements in the world that it's like, man, I kind of wish that was something. I kind of wish that that was ours. Like, I mean, I'm your typical fantasy writer. I wish we had magic in our world. I think that'd be pretty cool. And even in the science fiction book, I mean, obviously things get kind of crappy after a while, but there is a section in the middle where things are pretty awesome. I had someone describe the book in a review as an optimistic dystopia, and I really liked that. Like, that wasn't necessarily what I was went out intention to write, but I feel like that kind of nails what it is I did end up creating was an optimistic dystopia.
Well, I like if a book without dragons. It's like I it's fantastic because the warning says this book contains no dragons.
I have that conversation with so many. Whenever I go to conventions, the title of that book, people will be walking by, they'll be like, "A book without dragons," because it's a Comic Con. Like 95% of the people there want dragons, and then they'll pick up the book, they'll look at the back, it'll say, "This book contains no dragons," and they'll kind of just give me this sly look and be like, "But it really has dragons, right?" I'm like, "No, no, it doesn't. I can't be any clearer about that. There are no dragons in that book."
Well, there was a period some years ago before I self-published my first book where I was looking over some of the things that I had written and not getting a publisher, not getting even an agent or anything, and I suddenly had what I thought was the revelation, which was, I know why nobody wants to take on my books. There are no vampires.
That is very accurate.
That's the way it felt. It was like, and it's like, there are no
Right.
zombies either. And I'm like, I'm sorry, just don't do
Right.
this.
Right. It's like, okay, I have two options. I could add vampires to the book, which I don't want to do, or I could go my own way.
And so it becomes sort of like, okay, well, that was the thing someone said to me, says, well, then just make the main character turn into a vampire. And I'm like, it's not as easy as
That's not really the story I was trying to tell.
that. Well, your friend's comment about the book, the dystopian elements of it and the optimism, I did see that very strongly. Willow Ayers and his creation and what you do have here is something that maybe it's something that's been read upon or written upon elsewhere. We have a sci-fi story that seems almost possible because you use existing science and then Unitime is
Right,
created,
yeah.
which that got my head to spin a little bit because I was trying to think, how does an entire world run on the same clock? And
Right,
that
yeah.
really, but that also kept me reading, which I also was really cool for,
Yeah. Now, I was very adamant when I started off, 'cause like sci-fi isn't necessarily my wheelhouse. Like, I definitely write more fantasy than sci-fi, so I knew if I was going to tackle this, I had to do it very, very carefully. So I was really cognizant of not wanting to make things too outlandish. Like, I didn't want flying cars. I didn't want, because I mean, like, technology, like it progresses, but it never progresses as fast as you think it's going to. Like you look at Back to the Future and see all the things we were supposed to have, and then we didn't have them. So I thought, it's like, okay, well, what small advances could we have made since then? And so that's why the world, I think, feels very, very, very close to our own, even though it is a little bit in the future.
And it's interesting too, again, with characters, one of the things that sometimes happens with certain books, and it happens with television programs or whatever, sometimes the main character just comes off as a little too good or a little too perfect. But Willow is a guy who is so clearly flawed, and
He
yet it isn't
is.
contrived. And
Yeah.
yet, he was probably the most intriguing of all of the characters that I've come
Oh,
across. And
thank
in
you. Thank you so much.
where does
It makes
he
me
come
happy.
from?
I
And
love Willow.
well, and there's so much. It's like there's a lot to like about him, and at the same time, you pity him a little because it's like, here's a brilliant mind, and look what he's done.
Right.
And we begin to
yeah.
realize what he's done as the story goes on. Where did how
Right.
did Willow come about? Because I'm always fascinated by where these people come out of.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is definitely a story that had the idea first, and then I found the characters to create that idea. So it started with the idea of, you know, clocks being wrong, and then, you know, everything else being
Mm-hmm.
tied to that. And so I mean, it more became a question of who would be the kind of person who would make it their life's work to make this perfect technology thing that's going to fix the world. Like, because he has a very, very, very strong desire to, like, see humanity reach that perfect utopia. He's very, very idealistic. So I kind of built him off of that. And once I started with that, like, that was kind of the first thing I knew about him. You know, the second thing I knew about him was, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, he's probably a little antisocial, you know, he's used to being, you know, just kind of, you know, working with his computer or a small team. He's not used to talking to a lot of people, so that showed up. But I felt like I really met him when I discovered that he liked fantasy novels. Like, to me, that was really kind of the door into that character, is that, you know, even though he's a scientist, even though he's, you know, he's super smart and, you know, he's all into technology and everything, that's what he loves most, is you know, simple, good escapism fantasy fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So to
mm-hmm.
me, that was where I was like, okay, I know who this guy is.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, that really works is, again, with the character development, we see, you know, like the police officer who's got
mm-hmm.
his own sort of thing going, some of the strange neighbors,
mm-hmm.
the waitress who's just,
yes.
You just put that poor girl through hell.
I really did. I really, really did. I probably spent more time working with Zabby than any other character, just because whenever you're dealing with writing a domestic violence situation, like, that
mm-hmm.
has to be handled very, very carefully. You know, it needs
mm-hmm.
to be done in such a way that it's respectful to the people who, you know, who have been through that. And, you know, I wanted it to be kind of a not using it, like, I didn't want to use it as a plot device to get the character attention. You know what I mean? Like, I needed it to be something that maybe might make people, you know, think about this in a way they hadn't before. Or so I did a ton of research on that and watching, you know, testimonials online, and I mean, it was a very, very humbling and very difficult emotional research period for me, honestly, because the things that some of these people went through are just incredible, and the strength that they had to get out of that is just so admirable, that I really wanted to do that justice through this character.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly have given, and the other thing too is, it's like, when, you know, it's never so much the happy ending. There is an ending of sorts, but there's also the open door kind of thing of, well, where are we going to go from here? And
yeah.
And I've always tried to do that. I can't do a hard and fast ending. I'm just like,
mm-hmm.
I need to leave the door open, because life doesn't stop at the end
right.
of the story, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you have to leave it. You leave the door ajar just enough to be like, well, what could happen next? You know, could there be another?
Right,
that
right,
sort
exactly.
of thing.
Like you do
yeah.
get the feeling that, okay, these characters are going to keep living after this. You know, this is not the end of their troubles, you know. But at the same time, it's like, you know, but saying it is important to have that medium where it's not like, you don't leave the poor reader being like, oh my gosh, I just read 200 pages and I don't even know what happens in the end. So yeah, I definitely agree with that analogy, leaving the door ajar just a little.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Olivia Barrier, who is the author of a number of short and semi-long books, such as Sisters, A Sorceress, Curses, and Songs, and also A Book Without Dragons, here on the Brown Posey Press Show. Now, Olivia, I'd like to ask also about
mm-hmm.
your beginnings, because what makes an author often starts at the beginning of life. Tell us a little bit about your growing up. What was it like for you?
Sure, yeah. I think that a lot of my creativity and storytelling abilities come from the games that I used to play with my younger sister, Victoria. We played these
okay.
really like crazy elaborate games. And it wasn't until I grew up that I realized that most people don't play like this. Our games were basically like movies that we would revisit. Like we would have the same characters. They would do the same things, but we would just play through it again. And that was the game. And a lot of them were just, you know, bizarre, kind of like some of them were dark. I remember once we were playing a game and my parents were normally like, oh, the kids are playing. But once my dad was like, kind of like paid attention to what we were talking about. And then he's like, wait, what are you guys playing? You know, explain the concept of your game to me. And we did. And he's all like, that's a Dean Koontz novel. So we had like independently rewritten Dean Koontz for our game. But yeah, so a lot of that I think fed into me wanting to be a writer and keep making up those games that instead of, you know, playing myself or with characters, now I'm playing with characters on a page. As far as the actual writing, I honestly have been writing as long as I can remember. I every so often, like, will find something around the house, like a little book that Olivia wrote when she was like 5, and it'll be like, you know, an inch tall, and it'll be like, there was a horse, but then it rained, but the horse got under a cave and it was all right. The end, you know, so like so it started very, very early. And I had a lot of support with that growing up, you know, it was always kind of like, oh, look, Olivia wrote a book, you know, rather than it's like, that's real stupid. So, I think that
well,
I had
that's
a lot of,
good.
A lot of support with that growing up.
Were your parents readers? Were they avid readers?
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. My dad's more of a, you know, historical fiction, mystery kind of person, whereas my mom likes more of the fantasy kind of stuff. So I mean, there was a good mix with that. I also got a lot of support from my teachers, actually. All throughout elementary school, I remember I was going through some old papers once, and I found like the first day of third grade maybe. And the teacher was like, you know, write me a paragraph and tell me about yourself. And I wrote to her, I am interested in writing stories and poems. And in that sentence, I misspelled interested writing stories and poems. All four major words in that were misspelled. And I am just so grateful that the teacher didn't, like, you know, say, LOL, maybe try something else. Because that would have been a legitimate thing to say to a sentence like that. But they always were encouraging me.
I think I did something like that in junior high school for one of my teachers in an effort for her to get to know us.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what I wrote, and I didn't mean it in the way that I wrote it, but she took me aside and said, are you all right? And I was
that
like,
sounds like something you would do.
Yeah, and
like,
I was like,
is everything okay, man? Do you
I'm like,
a counselor?
Yeah. Well, and of course, if I'd written, I was writing mostly about the fact that I had rather, well, being a kid, I had a kid sense of humor, but I also had a slightly dark sense of humor at the time. I still do.
Yeah, that started early.
and I guess that shook her up a little bit, and then she had to ask me about this
about
weird kid in class,
kid in
and
class.
Then it was like,
I've done it now.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I guess that was just something that happened. But I guess then, so in all of your life, you've done this. And when did you come to the decision that it was time to self-publish, or how you found the independent method worked?
Well, honestly, it was around, I guess, 2014. Up until that point, it had always kind of, I just kind of been kind of told, you know, my whole life, it's like, if you want to get published, you do it through an agent, you do it through a publisher, period. So I'd never really considered it. So what happened was I was shopping around A Book Without Dragons, right? And I actually had a publishing company interested in it, which was like, oh my gosh, it's happening. So, you know, as that was happening, my mind was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to market this? And my first thought was, oh, I have that dancing short story. What if I like serialize that on my blog and then like put it out as a chapbook on my own? Maybe that'll create buzz or whatever. So I kind of just had that in the back of my mind, not even really thinking of it as self-publishing, which it was. But then in the meanwhile, I heard back from the publishing company and they were saying, okay, we definitely want to publish your book, but you need to make these changes. And one of the changes is we need the book to be in a consistent point of view, tense, and style. And, I mean, you read the book, you know that that's kind of the whole point of the book. So when I told them, like, that's not a change I'm willing to make, then they told me that we couldn't sign the contract. So at the time, I still had it out to, like, a couple other publishing companies, and, you know, I kind of just made a deal with myself that, okay, if I get a no back from those three places that I have it out, then I'm just going to do this myself because, you know, I understand that this book is not necessarily super mainstream. Like, I know that the tense shifting is not everyone's cup of tea, but I feel like for the people who do want a book like this, I think they're going to really, really want this book. And I don't want it to be made to be more mainstream and made to be less of what it is. And I just kind of found myself one day hoping that I would open my email and see a rejection so that I could go on with self-publishing. And that was just kind of the moment that I'm like, okay, if I'm literally hoping for a rejection, then this is obviously something that I want to do, you know, not even just like, oh, this is my last resort. Like, this is something that I would really like to experience. So I withdrew the submission from those three places and started reading a whole lot of blogs.
And you must have done a lot of research in terms of, okay, who should I work with to help me self-publish? Because my first book was self-published. Parasite Girls was done with Create Space or whatever it is called now. And it was easy enough to do. I mean, the formatting was a pain, but other than that, it seemed easy enough. But what did you look through, and how did you arrive at the decision you did? Because I think you said you used 48-hour books or something of that sort.
I did, yeah. That decision in the beginning was purely based on trim size, honestly, because Book Without Dragons is about 64,000 words, which, to put in comparison, most novels are like 80,000. So I knew it was going to be shorter than the average book. So I was just really, really terrified of the book coming out and it being like really, really short and floppy looking. And I was worried that it would kind of just look off-putting to readers. So I'm like, oh, well, if it was a little bit smaller, the cover, then, you know, it would look thicker, you know, and I knew there were smaller books. I could see them on my shelf. But at the time, Create Space wasn't offering that trim size. The smallest trim size they offered at that time was 5x8. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to make that work. But then I did find 48-hour books, and they offered a 4.25x7 trim size, which, you know, was perfect. Like, I could find books that were that size on my shelf, you know, and I estimated their word lengths, and so I could estimate the page lengths, and, you know, that was perfect. It's kind of, 48-hour books is a bit of it's a different kind of publishing company because it doesn't do any distribution. Like, when you order books from them, you literally go there and they ship you a box of your books, and then you are the person who owns all of your books. So, like, in order for then people to buy them online, them up online, and ship them out to people yourself. So it is a little bit of extra work. But there, that you do get them for a little bit cheaper if you buy a lot of them, and honestly, they did a pretty good job for me. Like, the quality of the binding was very good. The customer service was very easy to work with. So I've worked with them for some subsequent publications as well.
Well, what is going to be next for you? What is the next? We've talked about some of the things that you've got in mind. Is there a next project on the way kind of thing?
Oh man, I'm so scared to say something and then change my mind later, because I've changed my mind several times because I have so many irons in the fire. But the projects that I have that are kind of closest to the surface right now, I have a collection of 15 short stories that all have the same five characters in it. So I'm working on revising that right now. I'm not sure when that's going to be publication ready, but I think that when it is, it's going to be a really good fit for anyone who's liked the experimental type things that I've done before. And then I also have a fantasy murder mystery that's in the revision stages as well. So I'm hoping to work on the short story collection for most of this year, maybe dive in for a revision of that at the end of the year. I am also, in the meantime, because both of those are longer projects, probably at least a year, maybe 2 years from being out, I do have another novelette in the works, still kind of in the draft stage right now, but it's called Counting Boy. It's it's a bit darker, kind of a creepier, more apocalyptic sort of world. So that would likely be on the shelves before either of those two other projects.
Okay. Now, one of the other things, we've talked about events to get out there, and we're going to be seeing each other in Cleveland not too long from now.
We are. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, well, you told me about Cleveland Concoction, and you sold me on the idea, but for those who don't know or who might be in the area in March, what is it like, and what am I getting myself into?
Yeah. Okay. Cleveland Concoction. I mean, it is a Comic-Con, but it's definitely more focused on the writing side of things than, you know, anime and, you know, Star Wars and stuff like that. Like, you do still have that, but it has a whole bunch of panels, which is kind of like the funnest part about it. Is you have panels on all these different aspects of writing. Like, if you want to go to a panel all about how to create a good villain, there's a panel for that. There's a panel for just flash fiction. There's a panel for there's a not safe for work panel where it talks about, you know, like, you know, sex and violence, what's too much, you know. So it's just a whole bunch of really varied deep dives into the writing process. And the authors that are there, there's normally about, like, say maybe 20-30 authors, so you get a different mix of them in each of the panels. So you'll get to sit on some of those panels. Perhaps we'll even be on the same panel. That would be awesome. And and then in a separate room, they have all of the author books for sale, which I really like that setup, honestly. Like, every other convention I've been to, you kind of have your own table. People walk around, they talk to you, they look at your table. But in this place, it honestly feels just a little bit more like a very small bookstore where convention goers can just kind of walk in and see, here are the books of all of the people who are speaking here today. All sales are handled in the same place. And then you can take the books and get the authors to sign them. So it's a different feel. It's a very cozy feel. And they have other stuff there. If anyone listening is into, like, gaming, they have a fantastic game room there, like, you know, where you can learn how to play something new or enter a competition for something old. So it's fun. Last year they had also some live music. The Harp Twins, who were amazing. It's exactly what it sounds like, a pair of twins who play the harp. But, oh my gosh, they were just so good. Actually cornered them afterwards and be like, hey, how would you like to talk to me about being sisters and working as musicians together? Because that would be so relevant to me. But yeah, it's cool. It's a fun time. It really is.
Well, it sounds like it will be, and I'm looking forward to it for certain. Now, we must ask, where can people find your work, online or elsewhere?
Well, they can find it, obviously, through Amazon. The Bard's Choice is actually going to be up on Audible, hopefully by the end of February. This is my first time with an audiobook production, so that's very, very exciting for me. So that's going to be available soon. Book, ebooks, and paperbacks are available through Amazon. I also run an Etsy page, Barrier Books, and I sell hard copies of my books through there in case anyone wanted to buy a book with an inscription in it. Because if you buy it on Amazon, obviously I don't get a chance to touch it before it gets to you. But if you buy it on Etsy, you can just make a note. It's like, oh, hey, can you make this out to Samantha? And I can write you a nice little inscription and sign the book before I mail it to you. So that's also there as an option.
All right. Well, last question for you, Olivia. What advice would you give to someone who's got that story idea? Maybe it's already written. What do they do next? What's that next step that they might be afraid to take?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think probably the scariest thing when you're at that stage is finding someone to show it to, because, you know, up until then, you know, it's yours, it's your baby, it's no one else's. And as soon as you give it to someone else, you know, there's just so much apprehension. It's like, oh, what if they don't like it? So it's tricky finding who you want your first beta reader to be. I guess my advice for that is to find someone who really, really understands you as a person, because writing is just, it's so close to your soul that if they, you know, really understand you as a person, chances are they're going to be able to see what it is you were trying to say in your writing. Because, I mean, the goal is obviously not to churn out a perfect book on the first try. No one does that. So your first round of beta readers are basically to be able to say, okay, here's what you created. here's what's inside of it that's, you know, that needs to be polished up to the surface. And then you can take that from there, take that feedback and start working on it into what it was meant to be, what its full potential is. So, yes, I guess that would be my advice, is to just find someone who really, really understands you to be that first beta reader for you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Olivia Barrier, thank you so much for being on the program, and I look forward to sitting across from you again and having more talks like these.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Cool. Our guest on the Brown Posey Press Show has been Olivia Barrier, author of Sisters, A Sorceress, Curses, and Songs, and numerous other works. I'm Tori Gates, author of the Brown Posey releases A Moment in the Sun, Live from the Cafe, and the soon-to-be-released Searching for Roy Buchanan. This is the BookSpeak Network.